Hello, this is your host, Linda Latona. Welcome to the second section of our podcast. This section includes our featured reader, Michelle, and our sacrificial poet, Marcella. The poem by Marcella is entitled Magic Tattoo, and the short story by Michelle is entitled Owl's Oasis. Thanks for tuning in.
This is called Magic Tattoo. The Metro Police pay her handsomely to sit cross-legged in the park. Her magic tattoo does all the work. I'll take care of you, pinpricked painfully, invisibly across her forehead. The tattoo is like a dog whistle. The police watch from the bushes as strangers come sniffing from alleys, crawl from under railway bridges, leap from sick beds, asylums, drawn to the tattoo. She attracts the most exotic breeds, the long-haired, undernourished ones who bark out monosyllables, matted hair hanging in beady eyes, who spook easily, tremble, and think the tattoo moves. She draws the puny, sickly ones who want to lay a tired head on her knees, lap warm milk from spotless china saucers, who whine at night to keep the tattoo near. She draws the bulldogs, too, the ones who jump fences to get at the neighbor's bitch, leaving claw marks in her hindquarters, who lick the air for the scent of tattoos. She sits cross-legged in the park, glad to see the police rush in with nets and leashes, haul them off to safe, well-lit cages. She can't feed them all with this one tattoo. Called Owl's Oasis. I don't know if you've ever been to Owl's Oasis here in South Dakota. It's a really great place. When I'm driving west across a big state in the middle of the country, in this instance, South Dakota, my mind wanders. I just can't help it. Oh, sure, I try to take interest in the landscape as it changes from farm country to western ranch land. I look up at the geese flying overhead as they return for the impending spring and imagine saying,
"Go back! At least one more good blizzard is coming."
And you don't want to get caught in the middle of it. But that's not enough to keep me entertained. My mind, lulled by the monotony of the interstate highway, meditates and broods and twists and turns over the long stretch of my 10-year marriage, the separation that has lasted for a year in uncertainty and sadness, and the impending divorce, an object shimmering on the horizon that grows more real with each passing mile signpost. It wasn't so much finding that Chip had gone looking for love in internet chat rooms that drove me to divorce. Really, the thing that drove me to initiate proceedings was coming home to find him with a flesh and blood girlfriend, lounging in the living room, sipping on cappuccinos laced with brandy that Chip had concocted using the espresso machine he had purchased as a gift for me on my last birthday. Apparently, they'd already spent their passion in our bed and were now enjoying the sunset, visible from our living room picture window. Yes, that was the moment of decision. I suppose if I were on an episode of Law and Order, I would have found a mostly undetectable way to poison his next cappuccino, but no, I simply got on the phone and called a good divorce lawyer in Rapid City. The lawyer comforted and praised me for my decision and described in glowing terms the divorce settlement and the feeling of freedom that would come with the divorce. The decision, the destination seemed very far away then. I felt a little like a pioneer woman driving a covered wagon of my own making, headed 1,000 miles away to the promised land, ignorant of the bad weather, the broken wheel, and the snakes that I would encounter along the way. At my job as a web catalog production coordinator for an online clothing store, I check catalog copy, track web pages in production, write reports, and attend meetings. Vulnerable after Chip and I separated, I confided in an older, motherly coworker who'd been through a divorce herself, not knowing that every word I shared with her was repeated to all other interested employees. And as it turned out, that was pretty much everybody. The day a secretary at the other end of the building said to me, Gee, you should go back to your husband so we can hear some more dirt. I knew that I had been performing a free, valuable service for the company, something I couldn't add as a line to my resume. At least, I was careful to turn away from the flirty smiles of men who evidently saw romantic possibilities, not knowing that I'm like the grocery shopper who heads straight for the one item she needs to cook supper and checks out of the under 12 items register, refusing to be tempted by the sales prices on items she doesn't need. Ice still floats on the lakes and rivers. Even in the free-flowing areas, the water seems thick, the waves stiff and sluggish. It's early March in South Dakota, and there's nothing very spring-like to see, not just yet. And the road reaches out before me with scary predictability. Scary because the moment you get lazy is the moment when a possum, a raccoon, or even a deer decides to cross the interstate. In my case, even though I swerve slightly, it's not enough to avoid Rocky Raccoon. Glancing in my rearview window, I see her flipped over on the highway, legs wiggling in the throes of death. Taking the next exit, I turn around, head east on the interstate, take another exit, and drive west again, slowing down to 50. Searching for my critter, she is nowhere to be found. Perhaps she wasn't seriously injured. Maybe she just flipped over, righted herself, and moved on. More likely, she has somehow managed to crawl off to die, or another car has hit her, sending her tumbling off the side of the road. That was what I intended to do anyway. Move her off the interstate, give her some sort of dignity in death, so she doesn't keep getting hit over and over. I've wasted half an hour in the fading light of late afternoon searching for dead animals on Interstate 90, getting bleary-eyed and emotional. It's time to take a break. I pull off at the exit for Owl's Oasis, one of South Dakota's many kitschy tourist traps, which, nonetheless, I've been told has a pretty good restaurant. Sure enough, plastic signs designed to look like worn leather with letters carved in them declare that this is Owl's Oasis and that treasures abound. In the restaurant side off to the right, I am seated at a table that faces east, offering a view of the Oasis Inn next door. Glancing up, I'm startled to see another dead animal. A deer's head mounted on the wall, her eyes, quote, looking as if she were alive, unquote. To quote a poem I remember reading in college, I asked to move to another table. Certainly. The waiter is kind of burly with a head of shocking, carroty red hair. And he needs to shave. He's downright furry. He looks like a Viking, a big, furry, burly, red-headed Viking. Still, he's very courteous about the switch to another table, where this time I have a view of the interstate and the hills beyond. Studying my waiter discreetly, I wonder if a waitress called in sick and he's filling in for some reason. He doesn't seem like a waiter. He seems like he should be driving truck or ordering other big men like himself around, not waiting on tables. He comes over and begins writing a ticket. So what can I get for you? Before I can answer, he asks, that's a lovely bracelet you're wearing. Thank you. I stare, a little shocked by these words coming out of that manly face, holding out my wrist so he can examine the antique stone setting in the bracelet. This is my grandmother's. Truly lovely. He gestures toward the gift shop west of the restaurant. You know, I make jewelry and sell it over there. Nothing as nice as this. Still, you should check it out. It's under my name, Albert Afraid of His Horses. Afraid of His Horses? Are you... Yes, even though I don't look at one quarter Lakota. The rest is pure Ole, Norwegian, you betcha. Since he has probably received lots of comments like, you must have been teased by bullies in school for having a name like that, I turn to the menu instead. Albert, how is the prime rib? Excellent. I gained 5 pounds eating it, he says, grinning, putting one hand on a hip. That gesture is just plain odd. Most people would call it feminine. Possibly this big burly guy is gay? I hate to stereotype. I don't need to gain weight. Maybe instead, listen, a few pounds will just make you sexier. You should try it. It's hard not to be swayed by such compliments. Okay, I guess I will. Albert recommends some wine to go with my meal, and a short time later I'm enjoying dinner in a glass of a great Cabernet Sauvignon. Surprising for such a place. Maybe wine drinking is the main pastime here. On the restaurant speakers, the background country music switches over to a girls' basketball game between Chamberlain and Ellsworth. The announcer describes key players' every move, unable to hide his satisfaction when his favorite player scores. That player seems to shine above all others. The announcer's niece, perhaps. Off in one corner of the restaurant, a group of local guys appear to be listening to the game closely. Occasionally, they burst into laughter, hoot, or clap their hands. The wine gets me thinking about Chip. Anyway, let's blame it on the wine. That handsome jawline and sexy smile must have won over every woman in the five-state region to whom he paid even an iota of attention. Thankfully, I can also recall how he wore pants that were too tight and how sticking a toilet bowl deodorizer under the rim substituted for actually cleaning the toilet. Of course, it's hard to forget the annoyingly cliché cavalier way in which he responded to being caught having an affair. Sorry. I didn't think you would be homing up for another hour or two. This is embarrassing. My eyes are watering. Blinking hard repeatedly, I try to focus on the overhanging curtain balances with her old-fashioned cowboy friend. Those cowboys were living it up, some riding horse, some throwing up one arm, some sitting on a fence and jawing with one another. Yeah, one says to the other, my wife caught me with another gal, so here I am, back to riding herd and talking to you fellas. Now I can't even recall her name. That gal you were with, the one sitting on the ground says, no,
my wife! Dear, it's my waiter, Albert, who has picked up the glass of water on my table. Drink some water.
Right now. I shake my head, embarrassed that he has seen my tears. Thank you, but he holds the glass to my lips as if he were a nurse and I a slightly confused patient. Hand shaking, I start drinking. Swallowing the cold water stops the tears. I'm better now, but drink more. Albert raises one maternal eyebrow, and he watches me obediently drink it all. He says, that's a tried and true remedy that I've used many a time, usually after I've broken up with someone. He smiles, crinkling up his blue-green eyes and revealing a tiny, charming gap in an otherwise perfect set of teeth. Yeah, what lonely woman isn't a sucker for a handsome smile? He touches me gently on the arm and rushes off to another table. I concentrate on finishing my prime rib dinner, take slow, deliberate bites, sitting up straight and trying to look calm and dignified. That's what's needed right now. A little more dignity, a lot less humiliation. But my treacherous country song mind returns to good old aggravating Chip, as if I just can't punish myself enough. While it's not surprising that Chip had gone looking for internet love, he generally preferred the physical world, and everything he did gravitated toward that. He was a salesman, working for an auto parts chain, traveling to places that do auto repairs, all over the five-state areas he called it, South Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, North Dakota. Because he sold auto parts, he was often in a man's world. But his eye, as I soon learned, gravitated toward the secretary, always female and underpaid, often quite attractive, working at a computer and answering phones. He dressed a little nicer than necessary to appeal to those women, but those sales were lacking after a while. When he discovered the internet, his sales territory expanded. What attracted me to Chip? It's really hard to say. Chip dressed in clothes that were always about 5 years behind in terms of style. Of course, most people in small towns in the Midwest don't notice or care. His dress shoes were carefully shined each morning. His hair, slightly mullet, appealed to men who also cling to this hairstyle. It was not so mullet that it put off the women, who would hear that honey voice and be stunned by that perfect smile. He usually spent an hour in front of the mirror each morning, apparently never having grown out of that self-obsessive teenage stage, fussing with his mustache, his skin, his hair. What should have given me a clue about his lack of fidelity is that he lost 3 wedding rings and finally said, hey, babe, let's just not bother with that, okay? Reaching into my purse, I unzip a pocket and pull out my wedding ring, turning it over and reading the inscription, yours forever. I did not take off that ring during the entire time we were married, not, I'm afraid, until we were 6 months into the separation. When Chip and I met, we were both living in Rapid City at the time. We both had family there, so naturally we got married there too. It seems fitting somehow that I'm now returning to the scene of the crime. Albert comes back over and I order some coffee. I feel as if I owe him something more. That something is information. I've got to go to Rapid City tonight, meeting with my divorce lawyer first first thing in the morning to tie up some loose ends. Then it will all be over and done with. Albert studies me, his eyes now serious. He says nothing but brings coffee and a check right away. Just then, a large group comes in and sits in the other room, demanding most of his attention. I drink my coffee, pay for my meal, and leave. Wandering into the gift shop next door, I pass by all of the gaudy tourist stuff until coming upon Albert's handmade jewelry. I pick out one of the bracelets. It has black freshwater pearls and, interestingly, stones the color of Albert's eyes. A closer look at the stones reveals impossibly tiny etchings of horses. The bracelet looks beautiful on my wrist, complements my grandmother's antique one nicely. Standing at the cash register, I hear a newly familiar voice say to the clerk, "Don't charge her for this bracelet. I'm giving it to her." Startled, I turn around. It's Albert, smiling that Viking smile. "That's very sweet, Albert, but don't say no, please. I want to do this." He accompanies me out to the car, glancing toward the restaurant. "It's crazy busy in there, but I saw you go to the gift shop and knew what you had in mind. Besides, I had to give you this before you left." He holds out a business card. "I live next door in the Oasis Inn. Come visit me on your way back from Rapid. We'll talk over coffee or wine. And dessert. I'll tempt you with a fabulous dessert." I take the card from him. His old phone number has been crossed out, the new one scrawled in a thick but readable script. "Okay, you seem very nice." Realizing how lame this sounds, I find myself doing something I've never done before, making the first move. Stepping forward, staring up at those liquid eyes, I stand on tiptoe, but almost not quite able to reach his lips. Although he looks surprised, Albert takes my face in his hands and, dropping his head, presses his lips to mine, reshaping and polishing them tenderly, as if my mouth were a rare stone that he had discovered in which only he could see its beauty. My hard, dull surface gives way, shining forth, becoming a glowing gem. This is truly a man with many horses, but interestingly, I'm not afraid of him. "I'm sorry if I smell like restaurant," he said apologetically, stepping back. "I just want to meet you part of it. You're really quite irresistible." My face grows hot. Nobody has ever called me irresistible before. I manage, "Thank you?" If he smells like grease, I surely didn't notice it. Seeing his expression, I add, "I will stop here on the way back." For a moment, I entertain this ridiculous image of a cheap historical romance novel I saw in the supermarket years ago, featuring on the cover a dark, muscular Indian brave, and a voluptuous blonde white woman caught up in a passionate embrace. "You know," he says, "there's this recipe that I want to try out on you when you come. Buffalo berry creme brulee. Just have to think of the perfect coffee or wine to go with it."
He puts one large hand on a hip and tilts his head slightly, thinking, "No, I've changed my mind. I don't think that our next encounter will be anything like a frontier romance novel." Smiling and raising my arm, I jingle the new bracelet. "Those are some pretty horses." "They belong to you now," he says. He watches me drive away. My hands on the wheel are surprisingly steady, the stones and black pearls on the new bracelet shining and
swaying in the moonlight. I pull out onto the interstate and drive, relishing the night sky filled with stars and the open road before me, and the ditches and other hidden places wild animals wait.